to Day On Against the Grain. Did the years 1989 through 91 spell the end of socialism? What happened to people and society when capitalism displaced communism? I'm CS. The veteran Marxist Helena Sheehan discusses her memoir, Until We Fall, Long Distance Life on the Left, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Changes of world historical proportions took place in the years 1989, 90, and 91. The latter stages of Glasnost and Perestroika, the fall of the Berlin Wall, communist governments ousted throughout Eastern Europe, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War. How to assess these mind-boggling developments? How to describe the tumultuous transition from socialism to capitalism and its impact on individuals and society? Was this socialism's death knell? What sort of capitalism took its place? And how was all this viewed and interpreted by a committed leftist, a Marxist thinker who'd been active in many radical movements and formations, including the New Left and the Irish Republican Army? Helena Sheehan has written a second installment of her memoir. It has the title, Until We Fall, Long Distance Life on the Left, and it's out from Monthly Review Press. A sequel to her book, Navigating the Zeitgeist, Until We Fall begins with Eastern Europe in the late 80s and ends amidst the COVID pandemic. When Helena Sheehan and I connected recently, she began with this background.
I had grown up, as you know from my previous book, as a Cold War Catholic, and I made my way through the US New Left to the communist movement in Europe. And I belonged to a communist party, Communist Party of Ireland. I went to the Soviet Union. I did two stints at the International Lenin School. I had a chance to explore life in the USSR, also in the other countries of Eastern Europe. I mixed with their intelligentsia, but also a wide section of the population. I was writing a book about Marxism and science, and that opened out to all kinds of questions about everything. And so to everyone in Ireland and elsewhere who knew me, I was very pro-Soviet. But in the party, because I had a critical engagement with the Soviet Union and the other countries of Eastern Europe, I ran into trouble because it was just the Soviet line about everything and don't question anything. And I ended up, by the time we're talking about, in the late 80s, I had left the Communist Party, which was a very hard thing to do, but I still considered myself a communist. And I wasn't the only one in Ireland or the world who took this position. So I had a very critical view of the Soviet Union. I felt that, you know, it was a very imperfect form of socialism. You know, it could be better. If there were greater openness and greater flexibility in how it organized many things about Soviet life. So in 1985, along came Gorbachev, not just Gorbachev as a person, impressive as he was, but this whole policy of glasnost and perestroika. And when I had been in the Soviet Union, I met those kind of people. I knew that this was kind of bubbling from below in the Soviet Union and elsewhere in Eastern Europe. And here it was coming to power. And I was really happy about that. And so it was promise of a new lease of life for socialism, the kind of socialism that people like me had wanted to see all along. Socialism with a human voice, socialism with outstretched hands, socialism with economic efficiency, socialism, you know, with a more democratic setup. So we were all very hopeful about Glasnost and Perestroika, and we followed it absolutely avidly. And so in those early years of Glasnost and Perestroika, we were really high on it, to be honest, really hopeful.
You refer in various places in your book to the crisis within Marxism, to forces, and I'm quoting here, taking something full-blooded, integral and rich with unrealized possibilities, and substituting something insipid, fragmented, and decadent. Does this statement apply to some of what you found within the USSR pre-Glasnost, say, pre-Perestroika, that you found, that you were critical of, that you thought was should not be part of the socialist experiment?
Well, it was bubbling away primarily in Western Marxism in the 70s and 80s, a kind of postmodernized version of Marxism, this whole ban on grand narratives and a retreat to plurality and liberalism, really. And what I found in some of these really intense encounters that I had in Eastern Europe in the late 80s, and early 90s was the same trends there. I found that there was a retreat from Marxism into anything except Marxism, to liberalism, to positivism, to postmodernism, to even Russian Orthodoxy, and things like that during that period. And a lot of the people that were enunciating these positions were the party intelligentsia, which I found very disturbing. But What I realized a number of things, but about the party intelligentsia, the Soviet Communist Party had been in power for a long time, and a lot of people join parties of power because they're parties of power. And they're not necessarily the same people that would join communist parties when, you know, they're illegal and they were risking not only unemployment, but maybe prison and death. And so I think that in some of these parties, they were full of people who were careerists and opportunists that never really believed in Marxism and faked it to get on with their careers. And then once this this all broke open, it wasn't possible anymore. They ran and ran for anything but Marxism. Some people, though, in Eastern Europe, they had believed in Marxism in a kind of passive way. A lot of people accept a dominant worldview without really working it out on their own. And then when the gates were open and people were talking about all kinds of alternative possibilities, kind of felt themselves at sea. And it became more and more like the West, where anything goes, but where anything goes, maybe nothing goes. I think that in the world in which we live now, which the Soviet Union and these other countries in Eastern Europe was on its way to becoming then, is a world with severe, you know, lack of meaning and purpose. A lot of people, when the Soviet Union fell, the other countries of Eastern Europe fell, and they began this retreat from socialism, a very imperfect form of socialism, into a particularly brutal form of capitalism, not only felt the harsh economic reality of that, but they felt a huge void. They felt a lack of meaning, a lack of a sense of purpose. And there was widespread despair and suicide, and the statistics on excess deaths are quite remarkable. I even just saw on my Twitter feed today a figure, 7.5 million excess deaths occurred as a result of the fall of socialism in Eastern Europe. And having seen this really close up, having seen people's lives turned upside down in all of these countries at that time, it doesn't surprise me to see that really stunning statistic.
What do you think of characterizations of the period from 1989 to about 1991 as constituting the death of socialism?
I was preoccupied during that particular period with that particular trend and arguing against it. I didn't believe, and I still don't believe, it was the death of socialism. It certainly was a massive world historical defeat for socialism. It meant this transition from socialism to capitalism in a huge part of the world, something I never thought would happen. But I didn't think it meant the end of socialism. First of all, I knew really close up, because I was coming and going from Eastern Europe really often, that a lot of the people that were on the streets demanding reform were not demanding a transition from socialism to capitalism. They were demanding a better form of socialism. And I know that in these countries there are still masses of people who believe that they wanted a better form of socialism, and what they got was a brutal form of capitalism, but still believe that socialism was better and that some form of socialism was possible. I knew these people. Many of them are still alive. I know these people. The idea of socialism certainly didn't die. And also, socialism did survive in other countries, in Vietnam, in Cuba, in China. And in China, they learned a lot. In fact, nobody, I think, has studied what happened in those years in the Soviet Union so intensively as the Communist Party of China, and trying to find an alternative path to socialism. And I think that China is a really formidable presence in looking at what are the possibilities of socialism in the future. So, you know, there is still a massive socialist movement. It's still a really strong intellectual tradition. It was really still in power in significant parts of the world. But it was a world historical defeat for the idea of socialism and the socialist movement, without a doubt. But I never believed that it was the death of socialism. Never. And I still don't.
My guest is Helena Sheehan. She is Professor Emerita at Dublin City University. Her new book is Until We Fall, Long Distance Life on the Left. It's a memoir and a sequel to her book, Navigating the Zeitgeist. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. When the Berlin Wall came down, the Party of Democratic Socialism emerged, PDS, I guess, as the English acronym, claiming that it was a new party. What did you think of that claim and of the politics of this Party of Democratic Socialism?
I was very enthusiastic about the PDS at that time, because I believed that the priority for the left in Eastern Europe and also elsewhere was to find a new path that came from the communist tradition, but a critical reappropriation of the communist tradition, and found a way to form new parties and to form a new path to socialism in the very difficult circumstances of Eastern Europe. And there were parties with this idea all throughout Eastern Europe, but the PDS is the one that I knew best and really captured my imagination. It was full of really, you know, vigorous, intelligent people who came from the communist tradition, but wanted a fresh start, wanted to go through, not only wanted to look into the future, but wanted to look back into the past in a critical way and take what was best from the communist tradition into the future. I was very, very enthusiastic about this party at that time.
You asked many people why the force that was now the PDS, the Party of Democratic Socialism in Germany, why that force had not prevailed sooner within the party that ruled East Germany until 1989. What answers did you get?
Yes, I got many answers. Many of them quite self-critical, very self-critical. They said, you know, really, we should have spoken up sooner. They did speak up in many ways within the Academy of Sciences, within the universities, within their party branches, but they didn't raise it in a wider way. And really, you could say an awful lot within a lot of the institutions of the GDR, but not in the mass media, not in public debate. And they were very self-critical that they didn't push at the edges of that.
And you did visit East Germany a few months after the wall came down. What did you learn about how people in East and West Berlin were dealing with what was happening? And what did you see in terms of how people conducted themselves in the street and how that might have changed from the pre-1989 era?
Well, it was a drastic difference. I mean, on television, it was all, you know, champagne and, you know, celebration. And for the people that I knew, and I knew a very wide section of people, it was devastating. I mean, they were happy the wall came down. Who wants a wall to divide, you know, what was a city, right in the middle of a city? Everybody wanted the wall to come down, but they didn't want the GDR to end. And they felt that immediately the whole atmosphere changed. There was a whole debate about whether the GDR could continue. They saw the writing on the wall and saw that the GDR was going to end. There was one example I gave in my book. There was a secretary from the Academy of Sciences invited me to her flat for dinner one evening. And we got off the train and we were, you know, walking into her apartment complex. And she said to me, she said, all my life I've lived here before and everybody made eye contact. They greeted each other. Now everybody looks away. And it was a kind of visceral way that she noticed just the lack of eye contact, just the lack of, you know, the ordinary greeting of neighbors with each other, that she could feel the social order unraveling. And there were many manifestations of that. Of people telling me they just felt the society they lived in unraveling from one day to the next. And then I was in people's offices when they were, you know, packing up to leave. They had great uncertainty about what was the future. Their party branches and workplaces had been dismantled and they were establishing new neighborhood-based branches. Just every single aspect of their lives was being questioned and threatened. And almost everybody I knew felt that it was a massive hostile takeover. They felt that the move from the GDR to German unification was negative and destructive. There were things that they liked about it. You know, there were books that suddenly appeared in bookshops. There was, you know, they liked going into West Berlin, you know, doing a bit of shopping, but they wanted to come back. They wanted to live in something like a reformed GDR. And they started to see that it wasn't going to happen, that they would be second-class citizens in this hostile Federal Republic of Germany, and they didn't want to live there. But they wouldn't have much choice about it. And some people went to pieces, but some people were really, you know, remarkable. They believed what they believed. They would take the consequences. They were mid-career. They lost their jobs. They got moved further and further out from the center of Berlin. Economically, they became more and more marginal. But they had meaning. Whereas a lot of other people, they lost their sense of meaning. They lost their sense of social purpose. They lost a sense of social solidarity that they had in the GDR. And it was a tremendous loss for them.
The GDR, of course, being East Germany. You also spoke with people in other countries, including Hungary, asking leftists there about the causes of socialism's failure in that country. What did people tell you?
I found a different atmosphere in Hungary than I did in the GDR. one of the primary reasons for this was that there was more reform already going on in Hungary before 1989, and there was nothing like the Berlin Wall that, you know, made everything feel so different from one day to the next. So it was a bit more of a prolonged transition, but it was still a formidable transition. There was this multiplication of parties. In all of these countries, there was this multiplication of parties. But I didn't find this same desire. It was there, but I didn't find the same intensity of desire to take the best of the communist movement and to critically appropriate it in a new way. This was there in Hungary, but not with the same force and intensity as it was there in the GDR. And there were elections and, you know, the results were all over the place, but there was still a strong support for reform communism in Hungary.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My guest is Helena Sheehan. She is the author of many publications on philosophy, politics, and culture, including Marxism and the Philosophy of Science and the Syriza Wave. She wrote a memoir covering part of her life called Navigating the Zeitgeist, and the sequel to that memoir is the book we are discussing today. It's called Until We Fall, Long Distance Life on the Left. It's published by Monthly Review Press, and Until We Fall begins with Helena's experiences in relation to Eastern Europe in the late 1980s, and then takes us forward several decades from there. So in Eastern Europe, there was a new emphasis back then, again, the late 80s, early 90s, on universal human rights. What did you think of that emphasis, that the stress placed on universal rights to the exclusion of other concepts and ideas?
I felt it was a retreat from Marxism into liberalism. I felt that it's bourgeois liberalism. It's bland. It doesn't deal with the reality of class. And it's a retreat from class struggle. I still think that. I really don't have any great enthusiasm for this human rights discourse, because I think that it doesn't deal with the reality of class.
Were the people on the streets in these various countries, right, as all this turmoil was happening, did they end up being the people in power? I mean, is that something you thought about?
That's something I thought quite a lot about. The people that took to the streets were not the people who took power. In the GDR, for example, the forum, Neues Forum, New Forum, actually led the reform movement. And very quickly, in the move to German unification, they felt completely swept aside, completely swept aside. You know, international capital took over in all of these countries. It just swept in and took over. And, you know, many of the people were seduced by jeans and Coca-Cola and McDonald's hamburgers for at least for a while. You know, there were lots of, the West has lots of seductions to offer. Travel was big. People wanted to travel the world, you know, and why shouldn't they? But most definitely the people that took to the streets in Eastern Europe at that time in 1989, 1990 were not the people that came to power. It was international capital that came to power.
And remind us why that happened, why the forces of a certain kind of, as you call it, brutal capitalism prevailed, swept into power, and took power away from the masses of people.
Yeah, that's a very challenging question. First of all, capitalism was always dominant on a global scale, and socialism was always struggling in that kind of global context. Also, there were problems within the socialist countries themselves, you know, the lack of relative lack of democracy, the lack of freedom to travel, books being banned and all of this. And people wanted an end to that, and they were right to want an end to that. So that came into play. And just this idea of a higher standard of living. I mean, these countries, you know, did advance in the standard of living under socialism, but there were more luxury goods available under capitalism. This is undeniable. And people wanted that. And so it was a combination of the faults of socialism itself, the desires for a higher standard of living, and it was the sheer dominance of global capital, the way it pushes upon any sphere outside its hegemony, bearing down upon it. And it was a combination of all those forces that made that possible, I think. Of course, you know, I'm saying, you know, simple sentences, and, you know, the whole thing is, you know, infinitely complex and nuanced. But basically, I think that, you know, those are the forces in play.
You traveled to Czechoslovakia in, I believe, 1990. And this was part of, I think sometimes you were going just as a, you know, a person who was touring. Sometimes you were writing about what you were finding out from talking with people in these various Eastern European countries for publications, for magazines. In Czechoslovakia, you observed that, and I'm quoting from your book, there was a new orthodoxy now. The dominant worldview was now religious phenomenology, which means?
Well, there was a lot of emphasis amongst Czech philosophers on Heidegger, on existentialism and phenomenology. There was a kind of rebirth of religion. There were all kinds of things going on. You know, why Heidegger? That kind of mystified me. It's interesting, one philosopher said to me that he didn't believe in Marxism, and he didn't believe in, you know, phenomenology and existentialism, and he didn't feel any freer in the new Czechoslovakia than he felt in the old Czechoslovakia. And he also said one of the saddest things that anybody ever said to me during these years. He said he joined the party because he was afraid not to join the party, and he left the party because he was afraid not to leave the party. He said he led his whole life in fear. Now, as a teenager, of course, he was in Theresienstadt during the war. But a lot of people in 1990 were still living in fear. They lived in fear during the old order. It was, after 1968, a pretty repressive form of communist rule. And people were afraid that it was just, you know, another takeover. And they were afraid, you know, to say a positive word about socialism. Even those that were honest communists that, you know, hadn't done anything terrible were afraid of, you know, taking responsibility for everybody who had. It was a very bad atmosphere in Czechoslovakia in 1990, I felt. There was a lot of hope, you know, for maybe something that could be progressive. There were people that thought you could take something, the best of the communist movement, and build something new out of that. But the form that communism had taken prior to 1989 meant there was a big backlash. That said, you know, the Communist Party did reform and find its way into a new era, and still has a lot of support in Czechoslovakia, but not without a critical analysis of the whole post-1968 regime in Czechoslovakia. That was really tragic, what happened in Czechoslovakia in 1968, because it was a glasnost and perestroika, and it got crushed by, you know, the Soviet Union. And walking around the streets of Prague in 1990 was one of the strangest experiences I ever had.
Yeah, you cite as some of the feelings and conduct you observed in Prague confusion, regret, panic, guilt, fear, deceit, betrayal, settling of scores, struggling for power. You write that there was so much guilt here. Much of the lashing out against others was an attempt to displace people's own guilt. I'm reading from Helena Sheehan's new memoir, sort of part two of her two-part memoir. This book is called Until We Fall, Long Distance Life on the Left. Helena is professor emerita at Dublin City University, where she taught philosophy of science, history of ideas, and media studies. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. You write that, I believed that the turn to the right in Eastern Europe would paradoxically bring the greatest need for the left that this part of the world had ever known. What was the source, the cause of this belief of yours?
Because I still believed, and still believe now, that most issues boil down to capitalism is the problem and socialism is the solution. And people in Eastern Europe would discover that the hard way. In fact, I think that they, you know, had to discover it in a much harder way than any of us ever have. And therefore, you know, they would desire socialism again, especially because it was already a tradition of it there. That's what I thought. There is still a left there. There's a younger left there, you know, that wasn't part of the old order, who have this kind of analysis and this desire for socialism. It's not exactly on the mass scale that it needs to be. But what I said there has happened, at least to some degree, but is very, very hard to prevail in the situation that exists now. Capitalism is just so dominant. It's absolutely decadent at the same time as it's dominant. And we're all living under that. And people in Eastern Europe feel that very acutely. But it's Eastern Europe is a mess. It has been since 1990. I mean, it was good that you know, people could travel, they could read anything they wanted, except eventually they didn't want to read at all. Like most people under capitalism, you know, reading is not exactly thriving, even among university students and professors, for that matter. And so everything bad about, you know, our lives under capitalism happened there, only in, as I keep saying, a more brutal way. You know, that's been playing out all of these years. And of course, there are all of these, you know, internal wars, you know, dividing up the country because if socialism didn't hold them together, what would? Loss of meaning, loss of purpose. I even think the current war in Ukraine is, you know, part of the whole breakup of the Soviet Union.
What would you say were the major achievements of the communist movement in the 20th century, in the USSR, in Eastern Europe? What did the communists do in those countries before, of course, the failure of the experiment in the 1980s, 1990s, that you find encouraging, inspiring, and certainly worth either bringing back or perpetuating in some way?
Yes, I believe the communist movement lit up the 20th century. I believe that it brought a new sense of possibility to the stage of history. It did achieve the expropriation of the expropriators. It did radically redistribute wealth. It did produce an economy that provided for people's basic needs, if not luxuries. It provided a sense of social purpose and social solidarity. It was based on the principle from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs. Of course, in a very imperfect way. There were all kinds of things, as I've said before, to be critical. It didn't achieve this in a perfect way. But it, and also at an even more basic level, it brought millions up from darkness and poverty and illiteracy to a basically decent standard of living. It did all of these things. And I believe that it's important even now to defend the Soviet Union, even though it's been gone all of this time. I still think the October Revolution is possibly the most important event in the history of the world. And what was set in motion by that, what happened as a result of that, the possibilities for our species that were opened up for that, that needs to be defended even now. I think it's necessary to defend what's defensible about it and not to try to defend what isn't defensible about it. And I think that people like me who had a critical engagement with it had the best chance, or still have the best chance, of making a case for it. But I would still be very positive about the Soviet Union and what it achieved. And a lot of people's negative attitudes towards it are based on deceit and ideological hostility. The whole world I grew up in Cold War America, it was not a true picture of the Soviet Union. And I had to discover myself, I had to cross over to the other side of the so-called Iron Curtain to discover that for myself. But as somebody who had the opportunity to do that, I really feel that I have a responsibility to tell that story and to argue the case about it. That it was more positive than negative. Its achievements were monumental, as were its faults and its tragedies.
I think it was a couple of Hungarian leftists who told you, when you asked them about what happened to socialism in Hungary, that they said they emphasized underdevelopment, that there was a lack of preconditions for socialist development in Hungary. I wonder if you agree with that, and whether maybe there were other countries in Eastern Europe where socialism's failure could be attributed, at least in part, to underdevelopment.
Oh, this was an argument I would have made myself, that, you know, a number of people, a number of Marxists would make. And basically, it's that the basic idea of socialism was something that was meant to be built on the other side of developed capitalism, with all of the economic productivity of capitalism, the rich civil society, multi-party elections, an educated workforce, and all of this. This was the basic idea of Marx and Engels about what socialism would be. And of course, the idea was that, you know, it would happen in Germany or Britain or places like this where capitalism was most developed. That it would ripen all the contradictions of capitalism. There would be both the achievements of capitalism and the contradictions of it. And the idea that the first socialist country would be in Russia, which was still semi-feudal, was not the basic idea. So there were large populations that were extremely poor and illiterate and all of this, and, you know, hadn't developed technologies and civil societies and all of this. So I made that argument myself at that time, and still would, that underdevelopment was a significant factor in the failures of socialism to achieve particularly the standard of living, but also the more sophisticated social order, I think, that socialism demanded.
Helena Sheehan, a veteran leftist, professor emerita at Dublin City University. We are talking about her new book, Until We Fall, Long Distance Life on the Left. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. When communism collapsed, the U.S. lost its antagonist. I think the term appears in your book, the U.S. lost its anti-model. How badly did the U.S., in your opinion, need such an antagonist, such an enemy? And how was it left after the fall of its adversary?
Yeah, I found the U.S. in this whole original period of this new world order to be really interesting, because I had spent an entire decade not setting foot in the U.S. As you know, I grew up there, and but in the, I missed the whole of the 1980s, basically, and went back in the early 90s. And I saw everything really in sharp relief in a way that I wouldn't have if I had been living there at that time. But the whole atmosphere that the US was generating, successfully generating in the world, was the West is one. You know, socialism is dead, capitalism is triumphant, you know, the US is cock-a-hoop on the top of the world. And so in the middle of all this, I went back. And it didn't feel like a society that had won. It was saying it had won. But I just found the country in such disarray. It just felt like a society in decline. The lack of meaning, the lack of purpose, which has only intensified since then. But so, you know, I was going around, you know, the US talking to people just about how did they see the world. You know, on one level, you know, they were victors. They were, you know, they were the most powerful country in the world, and there was no big force standing against them. But what were they going to do with it? What was the vision of society? And I found people really just stumbling through life. And a lot of the people who I had known as part of the 1960s New Left, they were still there. They still believed more or less the same things, but they were involved in a very scaled down kind of activity. You know, it was much smaller, more contained projects without any big hope of moving from one kind of society to another. I found it really interesting to study the US in the early days of this new world order. I found it decadent. And I think it's only got more so with the years since. I think it's an utterly decadent society. And it spread that decadence into, you know, Eastern Europe and everywhere else through its dominance. But it's not just, it's not a national thing. It's because capitalism is more advanced in the US. It's capitalism that brings the decadence. There's an utter lack of meaning and purpose in most people's lives. Do you think that's true?
Yes, I do. I definitely agree with you.
Here in Ireland, for example, you know, Catholicism dominated for decades. You know, not only through its institutions, but its worldview was accepted as common sense. And in all the years I've lived here over 50 years, I've seen that crumble really dramatically. Ireland is one of the most secular countries in the world. The church is on its knees. So people don't believe that anymore. But what's replaced it? Nothing. I mean, we have a mental health crisis. People constantly talking about mental health, but not in a way that actually casts light on why there is a crisis in mental health. And again, I think it's lack of meaning, lack of purpose, lack of values, lack of an underlying worldview. I mean, this is a dominant thing in my life and in the story I'm trying to tell, is the necessity at a certain period of your life to lay the foundations for the worldview by which you're going to live. You know, not taken out of any book, but based on your own experience and learning from what's there in various intellectual traditions, in my case, Marxism, and constantly be revising it every day of your life. I mean, in 1989, 1990, I mean, I had to really think seriously about my whole philosophy of history, which I saw as more or less evolving from, in however complex a way, evolving from capitalism to socialism somehow. And there before my eyes, I saw the opposite happen. So I had to work through that. But like I had a way of thinking, I had a way of looking at, you know, the interaction of forces. And I worked my way through that, and I still had foundations. And whatever difficulties I've had in life, and I have to admit, like working my way through what happened on a world historical scale in 1989, 1990 was one of the most challenging things to work through. At the moment, I'm working through the bereavement of the closest person to me for the past 42 years. Whatever I have to face, having laid foundations in a worldview is absolutely core to working through everything. And I see so many people, all kinds of people, including academics, never having worked out their basic worldview. And I think that that is a basic cause of social disorder, including the whole mental health crisis of our times, as well as the geopolitical chaos of our times.
Certainly, you are no, at least big fan of social democracy, of social democratic parties, representing, of course, a often very moderate form, a reform-oriented form of socialism. And yet you do say in your book at one point that you wished for, what you wished for, was some fusion of the systemic thinking of communism with attention to the possibilities of transforming the system from within, as many social democrats desired. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes. I mean, my basic critique of social democracy is that there's no systemic analysis of capitalism most of the time in most of them. And that is the basic problem with social democratic parties. However, for those of us who have this systemic critique of capitalism, and we have this goal of socialism, how do we get from here to there? And I think for too long, too many socialists were kind of in the grip of this model of the October Revolution, which was wonderful when it happened. But this idea that there would somehow, mysteriously, be some kind of massive insurrection and the working classes and peasantry would, you know, seize the factories, seize the seats of government, big agriculture or whatever, and we'd have socialism. And at a certain stage, you know, during the period, certainly even before, but certainly during the period that we're discussing, in the late 80s, early 90s, I thought that, you know, we have to think about how to get from here to there. And I think that through some of the reforms that social democratic parties pushed and actually have achieved, I mean, the achievement in Britain of the post-war Labour government of the National Health Service, you know, that is a great achievement on the stage of history. And I think that kind of reforming our way to revolution is the way that we need to think about getting from capitalism to socialism. I think that I had this idea even in my New Left phase, as many of my contemporaries did, of the long march through all the institutions of the society. And so being in there, especially in crucial institutions like schools and universities and mass media, as well as governments, you know, standing for elections, being in national parliaments. We have Marxists, by the way, in our national parliament, Dáil Éireann here in Ireland, I'm very proud to say. And being in there, introducing reforms, but also articulating this broader vision and going step by step from capitalism to socialism. But, you know, there is a need to expropriate the expropriator somehow. And that's a very complex thing under advanced capitalism. It's not like miners can just, you know, go up and seize the mine, you know, take over the mine owner's house. Capital is ownership of the means of production, and capitalism is much more distributed and faceless and complex. Maybe even thinking about very, very radical distribution of wealth through radical, you know, taxation. But things like this, I think that we need to think about how to expropriate the expropriators. Because so, you know, there's been so much wealth stolen from the people who've created the wealth. I mean, how are some people so rich? I mean, there are only a certain number of hours in the day. And how could so much wealth be appropriated by so few people? You know, what did they do that, you know, they earn, you know, hundreds of thousands every minute that, you know, somebody that works hard doing manual or mental labor would take their whole lifetime to achieve? I mean, it's ludicrous, the whole distribution of wealth under capitalism. And so we have to find a way to radically reform capitalism until it becomes socialism. I think China's doing something very interesting. They think they can, of course, the Soviet Union had this idea in the new economic policy of allowing for a degree of capital ownership to build up the productivity of the economy. And China is doing this on a greater scale than has ever been achieved, ever been tried in the scale of history. And they believe that they can use capitalism to achieve socialism. And even though I'm very old now, I still have a fair bit of life in me. And I'm going to China in this year. I'm going to teach in Beijing University, Peking University, they call it, in the autumn. And I want to kind of explore that attitude, you know, the, how they see China doesn't claim that it's achieved socialism, but it's on a path to socialism where capitalism, at least for the moment, has a role to play. I want to explore that. I want to understand that. But the thing is that the Communist Party and the state are in charge of the dominant means of production and in charge of just decisions about investment. Anyway, I want to understand all of that better in the near future.
Helena Sheehan. Her books include Marxism and the Philosophy of Science, and Navigating the Zeitgeist. We've been talking about her new book, Until We Fall, Long Distance Life on the Left. It's published by Monthly Review Press. Helena, thanks for writing this book and for joining us today.
Thank you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.